Human Services and others regarding our alternatives to PCA programming for persons with mental illness. And we're going to start this morning with Dan McCarthy, Strategic Project Manager with the Department of Human Services, and Glennis Ewald from the Children's Mental Health Division. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Dan McCarthy. I'm with the department.
Glennis Edwald, Children's Mental Health Division, DHS.
And what we wanted to do, Madam Chair and members, was just walk you through some of the work that we've been doing on better understanding who the population is that will be affected by the changes, the 2009 legislative changes to the Personal Care Assistance Program. Some of the things that we're finding about the different subpopulations who will be affected by the changes, some initial thinking on our part, and then some information on recent federal health care reforms that might be helpful as we move forward for people to be aware of. So we have a handout for you and copies for people in the audience, and we'll just work our way through them. We're going to start by just reviewing the legislative charge. As you know, the department was asked to develop alternative services to personal care assistance for the people with mental health or other behavioral challenges who could benefit from services that may more appropriately meet their needs and assist them in living in the community. And so we've been looking at trying to better understand what the functional needs of these recipients are, what some of their characteristics are, and looking at the array of options that might be helpful in meeting those needs and supporting people in the community. Our charge requires us to come forward with a report to the legislature, a plan, in January of 2011 so that we can implement these alternatives by July of 2011. And so we'll also share with you information about our plan, next steps, and the timelines we're on, and hope to get any recommendations or feedback from you from your perspective that would be useful. If you want to flip to the slide that's numbered 4, and I'm going to just walk through some background information. I just want to be sure we're all on the same page. There's some technical aspects here that I think it's helpful to make sure we all have the same understanding, and then we'll get into the details. As you may recall, there's about 21,000 recipients of personal care assistance who are in the process of being reassessed by the public health nurse agencies across the state. There are about 14, 15,000 of those recipients who are in the fee-for-service program of the Medicaid program, and then there are also consumer support grant program recipients. That's a state alternative that allows recipients who choose to cash out the state share of the personal care benefit and use it in a more flexible way. But we use the same assessment and authorization procedures for those recipients, so they too will be reassessed. There's also home and community-based waiver recipients who are receiving personal care assistance as part of their service delivery package. And there's over 5,000 of them. I think actually the number's more about 5,500. And they will be reassessed as their renewals come up. And then we do have non-home and community-based waiver recipients who are receiving services through the health plans. A significant number of elders are in this category, and we're in the process of receiving that data and beginning to compile it and analyze it. The information I'm going to share with you today is largely on the fee-for-service population, but we're looking at trying to establish a consistent data set so we can look across the various recipient groups and look at them all in a uniform way. the nurses, just so you know, there's about 1,200 public health nurses doing this work right now, and they are completing the new assessments and making service authorizations based on the changes that were enacted in the 2009 session, and another part of their function is to make referrals to other service options that recipients of personal care may benefit from or need within the counties.
And the assessment for persons that have mental illness or emotional disturbance, is it the same as the assessment tool that you're using for the physically handicapped?
For the personal care benefit, the assessment is a standardized tool. And so currently there is some consideration for the behavioral needs of the person. You'll see as we get into this, there's a level one behavior factor, or if a person presents some danger to themselves or others, that's taken into consideration currently. But with the legislative changes that were enacted, part of what we need to plan for is those persons, because as of 2011, that behavioral factor won't be considered in the same way. But the tool is the same tool.
Well, I just need to express concern about that, because I think we need to be working on getting an add-on tool or another tool developed for this group of people. Hopefully that will be done in time.
Madam Chair, the department can provide you some additional information, but one of the things also that was enacted last session was what we're referring to as the Compass Initiative, and we're looking at a comprehensive assessment tool across populations, and that does include a behavioral component to assist people in identifying those support needs. And Ms. Edwell can talk a little bit about how we're trying to coordinate that with the functional assessments for people with behavioral health needs.
And does that behavioral component tell you what level of need that person has in regard to both community-based or hospital needs or somewhere in between?
The personal care assistance tool at this time identifies what level of need the person has for personal care assistance. The Compass tool will look more broadly at other community supports and services that the person may need in terms of including the person's potential need for institutional levels of care or home and community-based services. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess I'd like to know more about your assessment tool, but we can do that some other time.
Okay.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. McCarthy. And I share Senator Berglund's concern and would like to know the specifics about how this tool is going to work. For example, if you're only looking at whether someone's a danger to themselves or others, you're missing people who might be so severely depressed that while they don't have the physical limitations that would prevent them from getting to an appointment, they're not going to be able to cope with handling that function of making appointments and follow through and so forth on their own. Or you can have someone with, let's say, who's had bipolar illness and they're no longer psychotic, but they can't normally process information in a way that would require them to do the interaction that's needed to do the follow-through of their aftercare, say, after they've been out of the hospital. I mean, those are illness-related symptoms, but you don't pick them up with tools that are simply just looking at physical limitations or whether someone's a danger to themselves or others. Mm-hmm. And these people are not going to get the care they need unless that's part of the evaluative process.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I mean, we do recognize, and you'll see in the data here, that part of what we do understand is part of what we need to come forward with are recommendations that can meet a wide range of needs in some circumstances, and clearly the kind of circumstances you're talking about are situations that we are interested in figuring out what the best options are to support. I will say that one of the things that has surfaced is in some of these situations where people have had either a history of a behavioral challenge and or some other need related to their mental health, we want to assure that they're getting the clinical assistance that they need. So one of the things we've been looking at is assuring that in this assessment and service planning process, we don't simply provide supervision. And so it's finding the right balance as we move forward. And certainly your points are definitely things that we're hearing from the community stakeholders and others as well as we move forward.
So, for example, would the assessment be able to tell you not only whether an individual might be in need of PCA or substitute services for the PCA program, as well as whether they maybe need ACT services or whether maybe they need day activity services or, you know, any of a range of other mental health services that we might be able to provide to them?
The current PCA assessment is not that comprehensive, but clearly the efforts that are being made through Compass will be more expansive. And I think that Ms. Edwall can speak to some things that are occurring in the mental health field related to more consistent functional assessments. And we're looking at how to best integrate them, because right now part of what we're challenged by is we have a couple of different service delivery systems that look at some of the same people but slightly differently or at different aspects. And I think we're all collectively feeling that there's a benefit of looking in a more uniform and holistic way. So I don't know.
Madam Chair, I can either talk about that right now if you'd like, or otherwise I was going to talk about that later, at least on the children's side. What we've been trying to do in working with the Compass assessment to make sure we're addressing exactly the concerns you've been, both been raising.
Well, I'm concerned about it both on the children's side and on the adult side, and you can talk about it whenever you'd like. If you'd like to have me hold the question till later, I will. But since we were talking about assessment on this slide, I thought...
I'd prefer to wait if that's all right with you so we can talk about how all of the pieces are related to each
other. That's fine. Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Madam Chair, Mr. McCarthy, I'm assuming, I mean, I would never anticipate that PCAs would be able to use a tool to determine the mental health needs of a person other than their personal needs. And so my assumption is that people already will be involved with some professional clinician and that there will be some collaboration or some communication about the needs of that person and their mental health needs.
Senator Prettner-Sullen, you know, when they did the survey before they started the Diamond Project, they found 4/5 of the people were not showing up for a second appointment.
Still, Madam Chair, I don't think that a PCA can do a professional mental health assessment, and I don't think there's a tool out there that's going to help them do that.
I don't think the PCA tool necessarily can, but there are tools out there that can do that. And they can evaluate people all the way from what level of institutional care they might need to community-based care.
Well, it requires a professional to do that, Madam Chair.
Well, maybe it does, but I'm concerned that if we're assessing people and considering it a comprehensive assessment, that comprehensive assessment for people with mental illness truly be an assessment that is going to help determine what their level of need is.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Sullen, that just for clarity, the assessment is done by the public health nurse, and when we get into the clinical diagnostic and functional assessment, clearly that is done by a mental health professional. I think what we're talking about, though, is looking at the needs of a person in such a way that you can factor both those aspects in as well as the person's day-to-day need for assistance with their activities of daily living or other instrumental activities. For a lot of the people I think we're talking about, there's an importance of them being able to get support in some of those instrumental activities of daily living that keeps them successful in the community.
I mean, we all know that there are cases where people haven't been able to manage their financial affairs, for example, and have gotten evicted from their housing while they were seeing a mental health professional. This was happening to them. So there needs to be some integration, I think. Why don't you continue?
Okay. I'm going to continue on the fifth slide here. Again, this is just background and context. With the 2009 legislative changes to the personal care program, one of the things that was included was access criteria changes. And so as of January 1st, in order for a person to access this state plan benefit, they need to be dependent in at least one activity of daily living, and there are 8 areas that are listed there. Or they need to receive intervention for level one behavior. And the definition of the level one behavior is noted there as well. And again, that's the standard that's in place as of January 2010. And you'll see, as we look at planning for these people, there's another aspect of that that takes into effect a year from now. Right now, in terms of the reassessments, we estimate that we're about two-thirds done with the reassessments that need to occur. There's been a 6-month initiative. I'll share a little information on that. So we have data from about 10,500 fee-for-service recipients and about 1,250 consumer support grant recipients. We recently received information from the health plans, and we're in the process of compiling and analyzing that as well. If you flip to the next slide, basically, in terms of the authorization, once that assessment is done, a home care rating is established, and that becomes the basis of how many units of service, personal care assistance units of service, a person received. They're 15-minute units of time, and with the changes that were made, based on individual needs, if a person has a critical need in activities of daily living, in their transferring mobility, eating, or toileting, there is additional time that's authorized. Also, there is time authorized, units of time for complex health-related functions and level one behavior. One of the things I do want to just emphasize is that in the past, part of the concern that came up in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report was the variability in terms of the assessment outcome across the state. So it seemed as though there were recipients with very similar characteristics who were getting very different amounts of time through the personal care assistance program. So one of the things that resulted from the 2009 changes was a more objective and equitable way for this time to be calculated. And from what we've heard from the public health nurses who do this work, they're very appreciative that it's removed the what they saw as subjectivity and or variability in the process. So since the change that was implemented on 1-1, we've seen about 360 recipients who no longer qualify for the personal care program. About half of those recipients were recipients who were reassessed. And then there's about 180 new applicants who've been determined not eligible given the new criteria. And that's because they don't have a dependency in any of these areas of activity of daily living or no level one behavior. Now, moving forward in terms of who we're planning for, and this is kind of the important part because there's a much larger group of people that we need to plan for. Beginning in the next round of reassessments and prior to the July 1st implementation date, people will be assessed, and they're going to need 2 dependencies in an activity of daily living in order to access the program. So the behavioral component that's currently in place will no longer qualify a person for personal care assistance. And you'll see as we look at some of the subgroups and their characteristics, who are the people that are going to be affected, at least on the fee-for-service program side, and then what are some of the considerations? So that's what we wanted to share with you today.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McCarthy, Senator Sharon and I were talking. It appears that, is level one a state definition?
The level one behavior is defined in state statute. That's correct.
And it appears that it's mostly an access two diagnosis. I mean, occasionally an access one would fit in there, but not on an ongoing basis usually.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, I think Dr. Edwell could speak better to that and or...
Senators Prettner-Solon, Senator Sharon... remember, I only speak for kids. And for children, we would see access one disorders here, especially attention. We'll talk about this in a little more detail, and some explosive disorders. And I will defer to my adult colleague to answer with regard to the personality disorders.
Okay. Or development, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Or developmental disorder, certainly.
Yeah, developmental disabled.
Sharon Audio, Director of Adult Mental Health. I think that it would apply as well, Senator Pretner-Solon, to your question of some Axis 1 diagnosis would be in the level 1 behaviors.
But, Madam Chair, Ms. Audio.
Mr. Pretner-Solon.
Usually those Axis 1 diagnoses would be pretty time limited, and not ongoing, right?
Acute.
They'd be acute.
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, not necessarily I would think that they would only be in the acute. Well, I suppose they would be in an acute episode more than on an ongoing basis. That's correct.
Okay.
Well, and I think one of the reasons we're having this hearing and one of the reasons we asked for continued work to be done on this is we have concern, I think, that, level one behavior was all we had to put in the bill at the time. But I think we're concerned that there might be people that don't fit into that definition but who need some community support in order to be able to remain independent in the community. And so I think that's why you're seeing the kind of questions that you're hearing from us. So why don't we continue?
All right, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm going to continue on slide 10. Basically, I'm going to share some information about three recipient groups that we've identified who will no longer qualify and some of the characteristics of them. And just for purposes of the conversation, we've labeled them group A, B, and C. So the first group are people who have no dependency in an ADL but do have level one behavior that currently qualifies them. And so if you look at slide 11, this is a group that is largely young people. 68% of them are under the age of 18, and almost three-fourths, a little more, are under the age of 22. The majority of them are male. There's a significant representation of people in color. And we've been looking at other characteristics in terms of the group's eligibility and other some preliminary information on service utilization. Of the children in this group, there's an indication that about a third of them receive some sort of intensive mental health service or are connected with the mental health service delivery system. 17% of these children are in an eligibility group that is for basic medical assistance. These are in the children and families group. So these are not kids who qualify for services due to a well, let me just say this. These are kids who are not currently accessing Medicaid through a disability door of any type, okay? We don't know at this point if these are individuals who could qualify, for example, for SSI, but currently they're not. So they're just accessing Medicaid through a basic Medicaid eligibility door. 16% of the children in this group do also receive adoption assistance. And of the adults, which is, again, a much smaller group, about a third of them as well are receiving some sort of intensive mental health service. You'll see as we move forward, one of the things we talk with the stakeholders about is getting a better sense of what the type, amount, and scope of the service delivery is people are receiving. This particular group has recipients in the sample from 60 counties. And we do see some county and regional variation in terms of the use of the personal care resource. And so that's one of the things that as we look further at who's affected, we want to consider as well, where we may need to support counties a little bit more than other places in planning alternatives. One of the other things we've done in terms of this group, I move into slide 12, is look at their primary diagnoses. So we're looking at the diagnostic profile. And this is just, again, the primary diagnosis. So one of the things that we are cognizant of is that a number of these recipients have multiple diagnoses. But it is important to realize that a little over 80% of them have a diagnosis that is in the ICD-9 category of mental disorders. And just so we're all clear, that's a very broad category. It includes a number of different conditions. Conduct disorder, mental illnesses, mental retardation, developmental delays. We just want to be sure people are aware that this is not all a population with a mental illness. There's a much broader group of people that are included here. What we did is we then drilled down a little further into that group. And so of that group, we see that 28% of the recipients currently in this group that don't have a dependency in ADL but do have some behavioral issue, 28% have a primary diagnosis of an attention deficit disorder. About a quarter of them have a serious mental illness diagnosis of schizophrenia, psychosis, mood disorder, delusional disorder. 13% have autism or a pervasive developmental disorder. 11% have what's known as an emotional disturbance of childhood or adolescence. And then about 10% have mental retardation or a developmental delay. Just for clarity, there is one of the things the stakeholders have indicated an interest in is understanding how many individuals who have fetal alcohol syndrome may be included in this group. And so it's not technically in this ICD-9 category, but there's about another 8% of the total population who does have fetal alcohol syndrome in this group. So that's the first group, Group A.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McCarthy, can you tell us how many people are in Group A and what have been the discussions surrounding the alternatives that are available for these individuals who are deemed no longer eligible?
This particular group at this point has about, I'll just say a little under 600 people in the sample. And this is, again, a sample of a much larger group, about 10,500 records or recipients. I think as we work our way through, if we can talk about some of the similarities and differences and considerations, what we found is that there are some similarities in a couple of the groups. So maybe if you would be okay with us addressing that as we move through this.
Okay. Why don't you continue?
Okay. All right, Group B. Now, this is a group with a slightly different profile. These are people who have one dependency in an activity of daily living and are currently exhibiting no level one behavior. As you'll see, it is a very different group. About three quarters of them are adults. There's a small percentage that are children, only 13% under the age of 18. Most of these recipients are females, and a significant representation, again, almost two-thirds are people of color. There are 49 counties included in this sample, and we do see some indication as we're looking through the data on this that the recipients in this subgroup seem to in part be using the personal care assistance program to assist them with meeting their instrumental activities of daily living, their IDADLs, the things you talked about earlier, household chores, shopping, transportation, just making it all work so they can live independently in the community. As you'll see, there's a much wider range of diagnostic conditions in this group than what you'll see in the first group A or the third group C. The primary diagnosis of the subgroup, I'm moving on to 14, includes about 17% people with diseases of the muscular skeletal system. There's 16% have some sort of mental illness, schizophrenia, mood disorder, depression. Again, this is a primary diagnosis. There are individuals with endocrine and metabolic diseases, immunity disorders, diseases of the nervous system, and then a population, about 5% of this group, are people with mental retardation or some other developmental disability. When we look at the group C, this is individuals who have a dependency in one activity of daily living and also exhibit level one behavior. We see a profile that's quite similar to, you'll probably notice, the group A. The vast majority of this group are children. About two-thirds are under the age of 18. Again, 60% are male, significant representation of people of color. We do see, again, that people children in this group, some of them are receiving some concurrent mental health service. There are children who are also receiving assistance through the adoption assistance program here. And again, about 12% come from an ME eligibility group. There are some kids in Title IV-E foster care. And again, about one-fourth of the adults have received some sort of concurrent mental health service or assistance while they're receiving the personal care. And there are about 50 counties who are included in this sample. If you flip over to number 16, the diagnoses of this group, again, a pretty similar profile to the first group, Group A. About 75% of them have a primary diagnosis in that ICD-9 category of mental disorder. Again, it's that broader description that includes a number of conditions beyond mental illness. Of the recipients here, about a quarter have a attention deficit disorder. There's also about a fifth with schizophrenia, psychosis, or some significant mental illness needs. About 20% have autism or a pervasive developmental disorder. And you can see the rest. There's about 10% who have mental retardation or developmental delay. So those are the profiles of the three subgroups that we're looking at to plan for. And just for purposes of the discussion, I'll Senator, I'm sorry, I'm Lynch. I can't see your name badge. I'm getting old. Senator Lynch asked, the first group, there were about 590 people in the sample. That second group B, we're looking at about 550 people at this point. And then the third group, we're looking at about 400 recipients in the personal care program. For simplicity, I haven't added in the consumer support grant element here, but there is a corresponding impact in the consumer support grant program as well that we can share more information on. So, roughly, we're probably talking about 1,500 to 2,000 people that we need to plan alternatives for. Just from this sample, and that will grow. We are continuing to see people apply for and enroll in this program who meet some of these criteria. Initial stakeholder feedback. We've been working with a couple of stakeholders to look through this information, get their perspective on what we need a better understanding of in order to plan alternatives for. Their perspective is that we need to do the due diligence and gather the data and analyze this further. There's an interest in better understanding the current utilization of other Medicaid services by this population. You'll note there on the next slide that it would include how much targeted case management is being accessed by these people, if they're receiving other Medicaid home care services through the state plan, whether they receive mental health services for either children and adults, and or if they're getting some sort of care coordination through some of the models that are being developed for that purpose. There's also an interest in better understanding if there's third-party coverage for any of these children and what the managed care impacts are and how some of the state-funded alternatives for people with functional needs may be supporting some of these folks. There's also an interest in better understanding the diagnostic characteristics of some of the subgroups, seeing if there are secondary diagnoses that need to be considered as well as the primary. In terms of state-funded options, the other things that have come up in the initial discussions is whether or not any of these recipients receive support through a family support grant program, a SILS program. There are some other state-funded grant options, like the epilepsy grants or specific provider grants. And then the Centers for Independent Living also do provide some support, personal assistance support. Their funding comes through DEED. But we do want to see if there's any connection there and or potential opportunity as we look forward and how best to support these. So in terms of our initial thinking, one of the things we just want to emphasize is that it looks like it's unlikely that we're going to find one solution that meets all of these needs. But we do want to look at a range. Our plan is to identify and evaluate a range of options that will enable the Medicaid recipients who we've identified here to live independently in the community. And we do recognize there's a need to look at ways that we can combine the personal care assistance benefit with other state plan benefits or other supports so that these people can be supported in a holistic way. Ms. Edwell is going to talk a little bit about some specific work that's being done in the children's mental health area that we feel like it's important to build on. And then we'll talk a little bit more about some federal considerations with the health care reform.
Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. we've been working closely with the Disability Services Division and Mr. McCarthy and really have appreciated getting this detailed information about who the actual recipients are in these categories. And specifically, if you've been following along in Group A and Group C, we see a large proportion of children, only about a third of whom, though, with level one behaviors, are actually receiving intensive mental health services. And so that causes us certainly some concern about places where we can be a better partner to make sure that kids who do have identified mental health needs are getting the services that they need. So I want to make, I think, about 4 points through the next two slides of just about some things where I think our efforts are very consistent with trying to identify appropriate alternatives and work that will continue. The first is that I wanted to go back, as I'd promised, and talk about the assessment, the COMPASS assessment, and our potential for doing better integrated assessments across a variety of programs. We've been working with the staff who are working on the development of the COMPASS specifically to incorporate a validated, well-normed mental health screening tool as part of the COMPASS itself, so that children and adolescents who need a more thorough diagnostic assessment for their mental health needs are immediately flagged. And that then goes out to a mental health professional to do that diagnostic assessment and only comes back then to the rest of the COMPASS assessment once we have a very clear identification of what those mental health needs, both functionally as well as diagnostically, are. And that's the second point. We've been engaged, as some of you know, who we've been talking to know, in a great deal of work on providing guidelines and training on diagnostic assessments in order to get a better quality product across our providers, and especially to make sure that both treatment and rehabilitation needs are clearly identified in the diagnostic assessments. As Senator Berglund identified, we have been working with a level of care tool and incorporating that into the functional assessments that are required in the DAs, the diagnostic assessments, so that we get the best handle we can on what those intensive service needs are. We would certainly anticipate, as this tool, known in the child system as the Child and Adolescent Service Intensity Instrument, is more routinely used across the state, that we will see children who would previously have had a level one indication, if they have that severity of need, should certainly be qualifying for more intensive services than the numbers that we're getting so far. So we're working very hard on the diagnostic assessment component. Third, we have some alternatives that are underutilized within our current benefit set and are well aware of that. And particularly, as part of Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, we've had for about 7 years now the availability of a mental health behavioral aid as one of the components of that CTSS package. It's been an underutilized benefit for a number of reasons, and we have had meetings with providers, provider groups, in order to try to understand that. And while those reasons are complicated, and some of them certainly financial, other things have to do with the training requirements and perceived liability related to training that providers express to us. And so we certainly see that we have a responsibility to take on some of that training component and are poised to do that. Mr. McCarthy's data that we've just begun to analyze, I think, will be very important now to take back to stakeholder groups, because when it identifies some particular groups that have a really high propensity for level one behaviors but not necessarily associated ADL complexities, we really need to make sure that they are served appropriately within the mental health system. And they may be the very kids, children and adolescents for whom combining our current intensive services, especially skills training under CTSS, with the backup provided by mental health behavioral aid could be very useful. I got really excited over the weekend, for example, looking at that large proportion of kids who have a primary attention deficit disorder diagnosis who do have level one behaviors, at least from time to time, often though no complications necessarily with regard to ADLs, but who need the support and monitoring to learn new skills and then make sure they're really adequately practiced and reinforced so that they become part of their behavioral repertoire. Those are the children for whom we've often said PCA was not the right kind of service because it did for the child when the child really needed to learn the new skills. But then we need to make sure that we've really got the providers who are ready to provide the breadth of services and the integration of those services for those children. And then the fourth thing that I want in the next slide that I just want to really quickly highlight is we do appreciate very much the 2007 infrastructure investments that the legislature and the governor's mental health initiative made for children's mental health across the state. Some of those programs you've heard about in other venues, particularly I'll just quickly say we're very excited about both early intervention and school-linked mental health services grants as well as cultural providers grants that are expanding our infrastructure statewide. But in connection with the PCAs, we have particularly wanted to call attention to respite care grants that we have now to 44 counties. And the manager for those respite care grants in the Children's Mental Health Division has been in communication with all of those counties about making sure they are on top of any of their children or adolescents who are receiving case management services now and may have lost or had declines in their PCA hours to make sure that respite care is being made available to those families under the auspices of the grants that we're providing them. And so that's something that we can also track to make sure that where the PCA was really providing important respite for the family, that we have another way to see to it that that can be accomplished.
Madam Chair, we're going to move on and talk about some of the options then that may be available to support these individuals. Senator Lynch, we're to your question. And the first thing we want to share is, again, we want to look at the current Medicaid state plan utilization. And part of our interest there is, as Dr. Edwald mentioned, we do know that there are some existing benefits in the state plan that seem to not be fully utilized and or being accessed in the way that they're intended. So we do feel it's important before we look at adding any additional options or services to consider how the existing benefits could more effectively meet the needs of these people. Obviously, there are things that are already in place. We have the federal authority for them. There are mechanisms to assist people in accessing them. So we want to make sure we look closely at what's there and how to better utilize that first. And then we're also looking at what the options are that exist within the Medicaid funding structures. And I'm going to speak a little bit to that. Basically, with the changes in federal health care reform, there are now essentially five tools a state can utilize to provide home and community-based services. And currently, Minnesota provides the first two options that are under that authority, either the 1905A authority for a state plan benefit, that's what our personal care assistance program is, and or 1915C, we have home and community-based waiver recipients who receive personal care as part of that package of services and a broader package of services. And we can provide you know, whatever information or detail you need on the current utilization of those programs and costs. With the changes that occurred in the federal health care reform, there were some amendments that impacted the 1915I option. That was one of the things the legislature specifically asked us to look at as a potential alternative for this group. And then there also was the addition of what's known as the 1915K or the community first option. So we'd like to just provide you a little bit of information about those alternatives and then share some thoughts on our next steps. In terms of the 1915I alternative, prior to the recent federal changes, a state could only establish one 1915I option. And that option would need to assist people who had functional needs and had income. It had an income limited up to 150% of federal poverty. The important piece there is this: in order for a state to access this alternative, receive federal approval, is that we needed the state needed to have a need-based eligibility criteria for institutional care that was more stringent than for community services, And it was also previously possible for a state to limit the overall enrollment and maintain a waiting list. So there was a tool in the 1915i option that, at least from a state management perspective, was helpful in that we could manage the overall enrollment and growth in the program. If you flip to the next page, on slide 26, I believe, with the new law requirements, services continue to be tied to a need-based eligibility, but the way the law is constructed is you actually create an optional eligibility group if you adopt this alternative. So individuals who would have a need for this benefit, a functional need, and were at 150% of federal poverty or below, would qualify for Medicaid through this alternative. The state does have an option to add additional recipients under the revised I if those people need an institutional level of assistance and their income is at or below 300% of SSI. Again, there's a requirement for the need-based eligibility to be more stringent for institutional services than community care. And these are important on the last two bullets. The state is obligated under this revised provision to provide statewide the services. The state no longer would have the ability to limit enrollment or establish a waiting list in the long term. However, the bill does include a provision that gives states flexibility that as they are bringing up the option, the 1915i option, to target specific groups of recipients in the short term. But that needs to occur within the context of bringing on all eligibles within a five-year period.
So I'm not quite sure that I understand how these income limits fit into the federal reform in terms of limiting Medicaid to 133% of poverty.
What the 1915i option would do, Madam Chair, is actually establish, as I understand it, a new optional eligibility group. So if you had the functional need for the assistance and you had income under 150, you would qualify for that Medicaid option. So this would serve a broader group than the 133 that's to be brought on by 2014.
But for this group, you'd be providing an entire Medicaid benefit set, not a wraparound service?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding in talking with the federal relations staff is yes, this does create a optional eligibility group along with the services that are established in the 1915i. So the recipients would be eligible for the entire state Medicaid benefit set.
Well, I certainly think if we're going to be moving in this direction, we're going to need to be getting a very good assessment tool in place quickly.
Madam Chair, we would concur with you on that point. And I guess I would say, as someone who's been trying to line up the data across the different efforts, it's important we have a common data set, or at least a core common data set across the different programs and strategies to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, so to be clear, so it's being suggested that this 1915i would be all-inclusive, would not be a wraparound?
That's what he said. And that's why I think, you know, we're going to need to have a very clear screening tool, because obviously there'd be an incentive for people to want to get into this category in order to be able to get a Medicaid benefit set as opposed to whatever the benefit sets will be in an exchange.
Correct.
Okay, shall we keep going?
Sure, Madam Chair. The other option we wanted to bring to your attention is what's called the Community First Option, or the 1915K. And this is an option that will be effective in October of 2011. And it establishes a state plan option for services or supports that assist people who have a need for an institutional level of care, including institutions for mental diseases, or IMDs. The income limit for this option is at or below the higher of either the 150% federal poverty guidelines or the state's income level for institutional care. And my understanding from a colleague in the federal relations area is one of the pieces we'll have to look at here is how this affects elders. Elders in our state, there is an eligibility consideration here that we need to factor in. The state must provide the 1915K option on a statewide basis. Of probably particular interest to you, Madam Chair, is this alternative would provide a 6% higher federal matching rate for a 5-year period across any of the services or supports provided under the K. It does include a 1-year maintenance of effort provision that the state must spend no less on the Medicaid state plan and home and community-based services that it did in the prior year. It does allow the state to include and to provide some flexible service options. This alternative envisions both a more traditional, I would say, personal assistance benefit and one that's more self-directed or consumer-directed. And there are some provisions, including the state is responsible to establish and maintain a comprehensive quality improvement oversight of this. So that's the 1915K option. And again, there's some.
And would this option also be available to help support people that otherwise might be might end up in state-operated services?
Madam Chair,
I believe it would. Traditionally, those services have been considered IMD services.
I believe it appears that yes, that could occur with the 1915K option. Finally, and this is just down the road, but this is kind of an interesting thing to be aware of. The federal health care reform also included a provision that's known as the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports. It will begin to be effective in 2012. And really, this is looking at kind of a new way to assure that people, workers, are preparing for their future and the potential that they, like many others, may find themselves needing personal assistance. Beginning in 2012, there'll be an option, a payroll tax, for any worker over 18 to contribute to. The employer opts in. The worker must opt out if their employer is in this. And basically, there's a deduction being taken on our payroll that following a 5-year period, if you or any of us would have a need for personal assistance, we could tap that benefit. We're actually kind of making some plans for a future. What's important about this is when this becomes fully operational in like 2017, one of the things that states are going to need to do is look at how to establish systems that'll coordinate that private benefit, if you would, with some of the other services and assistance we provide through Medicaid. One of the summaries that I was reviewing did indicate that the class benefits would if a person was receiving that support and then moved into a Medicaid-funded nursing home or community option, the provision does have the class funding contributing toward the cost of that care. So it's down the road.
My understanding is that that is a cash benefit. So, like, if a person had long-term care insurance with deductibles or co-pays, this could maybe help them to be able to put their package together so they can actually afford to use their long-term care benefit.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's intended to be a very flexible resource that people can use in a wide range of needs, including setting up their own assistance with somebody they'd like to have support them. Our next steps, where we're going from here, We have been doing some preliminary work with the Children's Mental Health Partnership, given what we're seeing in terms of the recipients we want to be sure we're planning for. We want to definitely coordinate with the Children's Mental Health Partnership group. We've also been doing some work with the Home and Community-Based Services Expert Panel. Want to continue to advise them, update them, and receive recommendations from them, as well as the State Advisory Council on Mental Health and the Children's Subcommittee. We do want to assure that as we move forward, we have an opportunity to connect with some of the recipients who are most impacted by these changes, the primary stakeholders. So we're looking at establishing some consumer focus groups. We really want to get a better sense of clarifying from them what assistance and support they're currently using the personal care program for and what's most beneficial for their son or daughter, the person if they're an adult, or the family moving forward. We also think that there's some good information in some of the reports that have already been brought forward that we want to consult, and so there's some things here that we will be consulting and reviewing with the stakeholders as well. Next steps, last slide. This just lays out, in general, what we see as some of the milestones that need to be occurring in the next months in order to be on track for presenting a plan to you in January and implementing the alternatives in July of 2011. So,
are there questions? I guess not at this time. We probably asked him as we went along.
Madam Chair.
Next on the agenda is Ann Henry. Reagan.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society. We represent children and adults across the state with significant long-term disabilities who definitely use PCA services and have relied on it. And first of all, I want to thank you very much for holding this hearing. I think the, you know, about 2,500 people that face termination from services they've been relying on really appreciate the attention put to this. Just take a minute to review last session. We made significant changes to improve the integrity of the PCA program, largely based on the Office of the Legislative Auditor report, and Senator Pretner Solon carried that bill. A lot of training requirements, agency requirements, DHS responsibility, those things are all being pursued at this point. And I think those are largely beneficial and good things, and we strongly supported them. The other part of what happened last session, of course, was dealing with the budget deficit, and significant cuts were made to the program. And that's where, of course, we have problems. But I do want to let you know that there are plenty of people who are managing to navigate through this, and even though they maybe cut some, they're going to be doing okay. There are some people that have gotten, we've heard from anyway, a few that have gotten a little bit more, and the data certainly shows that from DHS. But I do want to make three points today or talk about three areas, and the first is the range of people affected, and you've seen that data. It's important when you're thinking about who's cut off of PCA service by July of 11 to realize there are two different ways that people will be terminated. One is the level one behavior that you've already been discussing. But the other is that we redefined what a dependency in an activity of daily living is. And we lopped off a bunch of people because we found them not dependent because they needed prompting and cueing in order to eat or in order to take care of their hygiene or in order to get dressed or in order to get to their medical appointments or in order to, you know, be sure they had nutritious food. People who need prompting and cueing simply are not considered dependent in activities of daily living anymore, and we think that is a very big problem. And I think that it isn't exactly fair to say that the data that you've seen about people who have no activity of daily living dependency means there's no activity of daily living problem. Plenty of people, due to cognitive limitations, due to the impact of their mental illnesses, due to brain injury, need that prompting or cueing, or they can't get through the day. The end result is the same, as if they needed somebody to constantly be reminding them every minute what to do, or it's the same as if somebody needed to do something for them. They simply don't do it. We have seniors with dementia in this situation as well. I should have mentioned that group. So when we're thinking about designing something for the future, we can't forget that, because the PCA service is the lowest cost service in the Medicaid program, and a lot of folks who needed prompting and cueing to get through their days effectively used it. We certainly are seeing that in terms of people now whose hours are substantially cut. I just want to take a minute to give a couple of client examples. We've heard from numerous adoptive families, and we're very concerned about these folks. Some have large sibling groups. These kids have a string of diagnoses. They have bipolar, obsessive compulsive disorder, reactive attachment disorder, certainly a lot of drug and alcohol affected kids. These are kids whose parental rights have been terminated, many of them subject to the worst of the abuse that unfortunately happens in our society. We now have at least two clients, adolescents, who are facing out-of-home placement because of a reduction in hours. These folks need in-home supervision. They have clinical services. These adoptive parents are very savvy and really trying to do the best they can for their kids. But they need help in supervision and activities of daily living. These kids can accomplish things, but they need that prompting and supervision, and they really need safety. And so we're worried about those families and those children. We also have a number of adults with significant mental illness, and I'll just give you one example. A fellow who was experiencing 3 to 4 psychiatric hospitalizations a year prior to getting a PCA who spoke his native language. He has clinical mental health services. There's good coordination going on. But this fellow has extreme PTSD, high anxiety, was not able to get to medical appointments, and eat nutritiously and really manage to live in his apartment. Since the PCA, for 2 years, he stayed out of psychiatric hospitalizations. That is a terrific, cost-effective alternative, and we don't want to lose that. We realize what we face here in the state in terms of funding for services. The second point that I want to make is the importance of data. We have to thoroughly understand the folks who are going to lose the supports that they need, and I think we need to drill down a lot further. I think secondary diagnoses are going to be very important. We see a lot of people with, say, significant mental health diagnoses who also have significant other health problems or physical disabilities. People, unfortunately, don't come with just one problem. And so when we're designing something, we want to be sure that it can actually assist people with the range of problems they have, because the last thing we want to do is send two people into someone's house to help them on a daily basis get through the day. One of the data concerns I have, I was happy to hear the department say today that they do now have some data for managed care plans. This has been a constant frustration in the areas that I work in terms of disability services, and it is not necessarily that health plans don't report. I've heard plenty from health plans. I know they report a lot of data. But somehow we don't manage to have reporting requirements that match up with what we have in fee-for-service, what kind of service, how much we've paid for what people. So I hope we're going to get that, because we definitely need it on all the seniors, and we need it on those 17% of low-income kids that are in this service pool. And the last area that I want to touch on are the opportunities. You've heard about the changes to the 1915I from the department and the new option of the 1915K called the Community First Choice Act. And I think the 19I has been improved under federal reform. I think it deserves a good hard look. I would say I'm not 100% sure on the income standards and whether a state can set a lower standard or use a spend down. Because there are vast differences across the country, you know, some states have a hard income standard and you don't have a medically needy program. Even if you're a dollar over 300% of the SSI standard, you can't spend down to 75% of the poverty level. So I'm not sure how that 150% figure deals with whether or not a state can set a lower standard but allow people to spend down to it. So I think we have to find out more information both about the 1915I and the 1915K in terms of the income standards. But I also want to mention on the new Community First Choice Act, the 1915K, there are two portions of that new law that I think are extremely positive that give me a lot of hope and that correct a problem we've had at the federal level and then also deal with, I think, a problem we have embedded in our PCA changes. And the first is the federal level. The act is also called Home and Community Attendant Services and Supports, and those folks are allowed to help people acquire skills and enhance skills in addition to maintaining. PCA under the state plan has always been sort of a maintenance service, an unskilled service. It's been a frustration to many families, to many PCAs, and to many providers. And I think a lot of good PCAs and agencies do help people acquire skills, even though it isn't technically part of it and it's very low paid. But now it's very clear that this new service, this attendant service, can help people enhance their skills and acquire skills. And that's, I think, very significant. The other aspect of the 1915K that I think shows some experience with some of the cuts going on across the country, and certainly the way we cut our PCA services here, states who want to use this option are not allowed to basically to discriminate, or they have to offer the service without regard to people's type of disability, the severity of their disability, and the type of service they might need to maintain their independence in the community, which would be we need to include that prompting and queuing. We can't cut those people out, or we risk them failing and needing more expensive services. So with that, I will take any questions should you have them, but we are definitely looking forward to working on trying to figure out an array of options for your consideration for next session. Thank you.
Ms. Henry, regarding people that need prompting and queuing, do you believe most of these people, if they are without that service, will meet one of the two of the activities of daily living that they'd be deficient in?
Madam Chair, the way that the law is structured now, that is a definitional problem, and they won't. And that's because dependency, to be dependent in an activity of daily living, we have sort of a closed definition. Either you need hands-on physical assistance, or you need constant supervision and queuing, and that is pretty carefully and tightly defined in the instructions and guidelines. And so if you can simply prompt someone, okay, now it's time to eat, you know, time to get your meal ready, whatever, sit down. And then when the food is there, the person eats it. Those people are not under the way we define dependency based on last year's changes. And that did result in a lot of savings. It's a cut. It absolutely was a conscious decision to say, okay, here's where we can cut people. I think some of the people that are affected by that might be able to get an alternative service, like maybe home health aid or something else. One of the concerns we have is we'd prefer not to see people end up in services that cost more money when the PCA service was actually managing to do a good job for them. So I think that's going to be another kind of data digging issue as we move forward. We are very interested in what the alternatives are. And I just like to make one other point I forgot on alternatives. For the children that we're working with so far that are in trouble because of the significant cuts, they are connected with Children's Mental Health Service, but a behavioral aid is simply not available in some places, and the amount of time you get for it, it's considered a rehabilitative service, so it's a shorter-term service. And some people are actually so affected by their variety of conditions that they need long-term support to live in the community. So that's another concern. I don't think we can just assume that we're going to be able to sub in some of our state plan services for some of the more complex people. It's going to be a complicated process to figure out how it all fits together.
A second question, Ms. Henry. How and when do you think we'll find out if these other tools that were included in the healthcare reform will allow us to do a spend down?
Well, I can't answer that. That's going to be a federal issue, but we're certainly going to make efforts to find that out. I would think, you know, there are lots of states in similar problems with that Minnesota's in terms of their budgets and needs to support people with a variety of disabilities. So I think CMS is going to be hearing from a lot of us that we really need more guidance on this to figure out what direction we can go. And we obviously also need clarification on the maintenance of effort and, you know, the 6% enhanced match, who does that apply to? All those questions have to be answered, I think, and we'll be pursuing them along with the department and I think colleagues in many other states. But it's really a CMS issue.
Well, I understand that. I just thought maybe they had given some indication of when they would be giving guidance.
Madam Chair, so far I am finding nothing. I think they're very backed up, probably answering questions about the early expansion states for the other areas we're working on in federal reform.
Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Henry, the definitional problem that you were talking about and Senator Berglund was asking about, I guess what I'm wondering is if there's a difference between, say, for example, a person who doesn't need constant supervision and formerly would have qualified to have a PCA, though, because maybe they would, just to use an example, forget to make a meal for themselves, where maybe there's a way to provide a service for someone in that situation. I don't know whether it might be Meals on Wheels or something where you don't need to have someone constantly, being paid for constant hours in order to make sure that person gets adequate nutrition, as opposed to other situations where I think the way I was understanding the chair's question, by definition, it kind of amounts to the same thing, and maybe the person should qualify for services because even though if there's something they could technically do on their own, if without prompting they are not doing it, doesn't that boil down to the same thing? And certainly I would think a person could make the argument that they're not capable of doing something if in fact they're not going to do it without that kind of support.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I agree that when we're talking about supporting people at home, we need to be results-oriented. If they don't eat, if they don't get out of bed, it's a problem. And the help they need to do that should not either rule them in or rule them out of that kind of help. But I think right now we do have some barriers in our law, and I think that is one of the things that does need examination in the development of these alternatives. And I also want to say that we really agree that whatever other services are out there, we really are trying to connect people with and seeking, and the law does require the public health nurse in the assessment to refer people to other things. And I think, as Dan McCarthy mentioned earlier, the new COMPASS assessment the department's working on hopefully will be thorough enough to help identify if someone just needs periodic help or, you know, what kind of help, and then get them to the right service and not over-serve people but also not leave folks out so they don't get any help at all.
Are there there other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Henry.
Thank you.
Ms. Reagan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies and the current co-chair of the Children's Mental Health Partnership. I also appreciate your having this hearing today. I think from the perspective of children's advocates and providers, we were actually surprised at the large percentage of children that will lose PCA services. We were surprised at the large percentage of children with mental health needs that are receiving PCA services and not currently receiving mental health services. So we're very interested in working with the department on what alternatives there need to be for these children. As Mr. McCarthy indicated, there is a variability around the state. I think that may correspond with the availability of community-based and in-home kinds of services for families. We're also, as Ms. Henry indicated, interested in getting more data. How many of these children are being supportive in adoptive families or foster families? What will happen if they don't have that support? Frankly, we don't have the infrastructure in this state anymore. Even if they do need out-of-home placement, that necessarily isn't necessarily going to be available to them. So I think it's very important that we try to figure out what services could be provided. As Dr. Edwell indicated, mental health behavioral aids might well be more appropriate to serve these kids, but there are some significant barriers to providing that service. And rates are one. The rate for that service is very, very low. And the supervision needs and the training needs, as Dr. Edwell mentioned. It's really important when you have lower-skilled people that you have good supervision and good training for those people. And the rates, there is no funding for training, there is no funding for supervision, so the rates have to support all three of those activities. And frankly, that's been a significant barrier for the CTSS providers. I also agree with you, Senator Berglund, that the assessment is going to be key and that it needs to be comprehensive and able to address what the mental health needs are of this population. So we look forward to working with the department and hope that in the end this will be a system that will better serve children and their families. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Now, thank you very much.
Senate File 2728, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I have an A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment is in our packets.
This bill was drafted before the governor's budget came out, and we had included some things in it that we wanted to get fiscal notes on, but this time I'd like to narrow the bill down.
The A2 amendment deletes section 2, 4, and 5 of the bill. Any questions from members? Sections 2, 4, and 5.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, what's the reasoning to narrow it down, because of cost or fiscal notes or...
Senator
Originally,
Berglund.
Madam Chair, we had drafted the bill to include a number of topics at the beginning of the session, thinking we would need to get fiscal notes on some ideas. some of the ideas have been included in the governor's budget now. Other ideas, we're thinking maybe we don't need them anymore. And so that would be the reason for the amendment.
Any other questions on the A2? All right. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair, members, what's left in the bill is the nursing home surcharge concept. And in this bill, the surcharge would be increased by $485 per bed for all nursing facilities, and the increase would be effective July 1st of 2010. And the external fixed rate would be increased for nursing facilities by $1.66. And it would generate some revenue. The idea would be here to be able to avoid doing other long-term care cuts that would be included in the governor's budget. And I would be ready to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, does your bill determine how any increase in additional revenue would be distributed as far as, you know, is it going to pay for rebasing? Would it pay in another way? Or is it just simply to avoid the cuts that that we have within our target?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it would be for balancing the budget.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, before it came up to the Senate, this was one of the things in our hometowns that we heard about, and people were just really, you know, pretty outraged about it. Back home, we call this the granny tax, and it's my understanding it started when the state was trying to deal with some general fund deficits in the past. Excuse me. And this was a tax or a fee attached onto nursing home beds, but there were no increased services to nursing homes, no increased benefits. The patients or residents there weren't getting any other services or benefits. It was simply a tax attached to each bed in nursing homes across the state, and then that money goes from those clients or recipients straight into the general fund. And this has always been one of the things that I would have wanted to reverse being up here. So I'm really having difficulty with this bill, not only just continuing as it was, but increasing rates on it. I just don't think I'm going to be able to support this. And I'm sorry, I know it creates a new revenue stream, but on some of the most vulnerable people that we have in the state and putting more burden on nursing homes, I just can't go down that path.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson Ropes, I guess a benefit that nursing home residents would have is that they would not be losing services that otherwise they would be losing if we have to make cuts to the nursing home rates.
Question. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, how does this capture more revenue? Does it get federal?
Yes.
Money?
Senator Berglund.
Can you explain how that works?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, what happens is that we generate revenue that we can then use to increase the rates to help offset some of the impact of the Medicaid surcharge. And, of course, that draws federal money in to help generate revenue.
Senator Coring.
And Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, so when we put this fee on, but they are going to get increased revenue so that this pays back the money that they're being surcharged,
well, Senator
right?
Coring,
Senator
I'm
Berglund.
Not going to, Madam Chair and Senator Coring, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. I mean, you know, I think it's better than cutting. nursing home rates, as the governor has proposed to do. When we do that, we lose a state dollar. We save a state dollar, but we also lose a federal dollar. But if a nursing home has vacant beds, then, you know, there can be problems for them in regard to this. I mean, it's similar to the issues that we heard about when we talked about the ICFMR surcharge. Usually nursing home beds don't stay vacant forever, and so, you know, hopefully it would be a temporary problem if they have one. It's just the opposite of cutting the rates. We cut a rate, you save a state dollar, but you lose a federal dollar. In this case, we generate a federal dollar by generating a state dollar.
Okay. Senator Coring, a follow-up?
And then, yeah, so I guess if we're going to use the leverage, or I don't know what the right word is, the nursing home by putting this additional fee on there, and we're leveraging more federal money, shouldn't we put that money in, direct that money directly towards the nursing home?
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Coring, we do increase the nursing facility rates in the bill. And then there is some revenue that is also then generated to help solve the budget deficit.
And members, that rate increases, it's on 3.19. It moves from 8.86 to 10.52. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, I understand, I think, why it would be better to for nursing homes and for patients to try to increase payments to nursing home rather than cutting their rates. And I guess what the governor had in mind was he was going to lift the law that required everyone to be charged at the same rate. And so for people who weren't being paid through public programs, I think one estimate that I heard, and I'm not sure if anyone could correct this if it's wrong, but that rather than, I think this is a $480 per month increase that would happen?
No, it's per year.
Oh, per year? Okay.
Per year.
Because I think under the governor's plan, I was hearing that rates could go up for people in private pay by possibly a couple $1,000 a month. And, you know, that would obviously cost people a lot more if something like that happened. But the concern that I have, and as I've been looking at nursing home rates this session, I've asked the department for a lot of information, and it seems as though my concern has always been the disparity in how we fund nursing homes. The fact that there are some nursing homes and there seems to be a higher percentage of nursing homes closing in the ones among the group that are played at the lower rural rates. And I don't believe that the actual cost of running those facilities really has anything to do with where they're located. It might have to do with the acuity of the patient population that they're treating and a lot of other factors. But as I got a lot of information about those payment rates, it was really hard to explain why some nursing homes are being paid at such a high rate. And now I'm not even talking about geographically, but within the same geographic area, there's a huge difference between what some nursing homes are being paid and what other nursing homes are being paid. And the department really wasn't able to explain a good justification or rationale for why this big disparity. And because even after we took out the factoring for different acuities and whether they were attached to a hospital or not or that type of thing, there were still these big disparities that are not addressed by our current method of funding nursing homes. So I would really... I'm interested in whether this change in payment rate does anything to widen that disparity gap, close it, or just keeps it the same.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it was not my intention with this bill to be reforming nursing home rates. It was my intention with this bill to generate a revenue source so that we would not have to cut nursing homes. And, you know, I think I've heard from a number of you on both sides of the aisle that you would prefer a budget bill that didn't have to do that if possible. And I'm hard-pressed to find another way not to do that. So I realize this may not be the most desirable solution in the world, but I think it's the best alternative we've got.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. In terms of the amendment that you have offered, when I looked at this before, Senator Berglund, help me understand, by eliminating Section 4, that's where there is some language that differentiates who's impacted by this, by their operating payment rate. Is that correct? That language is language that wasn't, that would have been in the bill, that would have treated only the top 40%, I think, of those at the top 40% of payment rate, which
Madam
would
Chair.
Have been adjusting that. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, this was a way to do a nursing home rate cut on kind of a graduated basis based on cutting those with the highest rates the most. We did discuss this last year, and I included it in this bill to get an updated fiscal note on it. Since that time, I've heard about a number of problems that this, there is no solution that doesn't have problems, believe me. So I've heard about the problems that this would create, and I believe we don't need both solutions, so I have deleted this from the bill. At this time, I believe if we can get this revenue from the nursing home surcharge increase, that we won't need to cut any nursing home rate.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I am anxious to hear from the industry, but if I'm correct with my calculations, the $485 per bed per year is about $40 a cost to the nursing home per month. Right? Okay.
Right, but then we increase.
And then, right. And then, Madam Chair, and then you have $1.66 per resident per day. So they really are making $49.80
right.
a month. Is that correct? But am I right on those calculations?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, you're right. However, there are Medicare bed days and there are vacant beds. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I would be interested, though, to hear where this puts us. This is a granny tax. You're right, Senator Erickson Robes. This is a granny tax. It would be interesting to see where this puts us in line with, if we're just way out there in orbit as far as other areas and states.
Well, we would be under the CMS 5.5% provider revenue cap that they have established. So I am assuming, and I know for a fact, that there are other states that did this last year in their budgets. So we're not way out there.
I'm going to call on Senator Olson, and then we'll take the testimony. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just following up on Senator Rosen's question, does that mean that we're giving back roughly the equivalent of what we're charging in a tax as a way to capture some additional federal funding? Is that essentially
yes.
the point of what we're doing? So we're really not, maybe this is different than a granny tax or what was earlier called the granny tax in the sense that we're giving back roughly what we're taking, except we're adding new revenue through a federal stream. And then we're rather than just taking money away and then using it to plug the general deficit. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think you just described what I was trying to say earlier. Instead of cutting a state dollar and losing a federal dollar, we are increasing a state dollar and getting a federal dollar. And yes, then we're giving them the amount of the state increase and keeping the federal funding to try to keep them whole.
Senator Berglund, if I may, we...
It is the principle of a Medicaid surcharge, and that is how this operates. Every Medicaid surcharge has some impact on facilities based on their unique circumstances. But we know what a rate cut has in terms of an impact on facilities. So
we had similar conversation in division with regard to hospital surcharges some time ago, and one of the
That's a little bit different, though, because that is a surcharge on their gross revenues, and then you can increase your Medicaid rates. In this case, it's more on beds. So,
but the rationale there, Senator Berglund, if
it does have a different slightly different impact on different facilities based on their makeup in terms of their private pay, their Medicare beds, and their Medicaid.
It was a way that we could address additional federal monies.
Yes.
I think is
yes.
The correlation
all
that I'm trying to make there.
All of these surcharges do that.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I might mention that the $485 is much smaller than the $1,700 that the governor required in 2003. And at that time, I don't remember any efforts to hold the nursing homes harmless.
If we could take some testimony.
Yes, I'd like to do that.
Ms. Thurlow and Ms. Cullen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think I'll go first. Patty Cullen, President, CEO of Care Providers in Minnesota. And I think rather than doing testimony, I'm going to respond to make sure I cover everything that was brought up by committee members. First, I do want to thank Senator Berglund for the A2 amendment. It will prevent many, many phone calls from coming my way and your way by deleting that one particular section that would actually have had the impact of closing quite a few of my member facilities. So thank you for that, and it'll be in our newsletter so the calls can stop to your place too. Secondly, there was a couple of the questions that came out. Other states, if they haven't already used the nursing home surcharge program during this round of their budget deficits, they are. The last survey we had done with my National Association of all the states, most of them are looking at ways to implement a very similar surcharge program and getting to the cap that the federal government allows. So this is not anything that's going to be unique to our state to get to that. It's fairly common as states have budget deficits to look at mechanisms to get federal funding to fill in the gap, and that's essentially what this does. In terms of holding the facilities harmless, the mechanism behind the two sections that are left in this bill allows about a 0.80 divisor, meaning that if you have 20% of your beds that are either empty or Medicare, you'll get as much back as you pay out. In the past, that hasn't been the case. In past surcharge initiatives, the divisor has been different. So facilities have had to essentially pay a surcharge on beds that were empty or that were Medicare at a higher rate. And they would see a loss of, $10,000, $15,000, $30,000 a year, depending upon the empty and Medicare beds. This particular proposal at an 80% or a 0.8 divisor with the return means most facilities will get back whatever they pay out. So essentially, there won't be implications similar to what a cut would do. A cut is lost revenue, staff layoff, staff hours. This would keep most facilities on even keel with this type of divisor. So I would, we're watching the numbers as this bill goes forward to make sure that divisor stays as is. I also wanted to mention in terms of the lost revenue and emphasize that as well, that whenever there's a cut because of the private match and our private pay, a dollar in lost state revenue cut means $3 in lost revenue to the facilities. So anytime we can go the other way on that formula, you don't see that 3-to-1 loss ratio, and I think that's an important factor to put in place as well. So I think that covers some of the questions that came up, and I'll let Carrie speak a little bit to this, and then I'll take any questions that you may have.
Ms. Thurlow, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative as well. I want to echo some of the comments that Ms. Cullen made. Specifically, we were asked to come here and discuss the surcharge versus the cuts proposed in the governor's bill. And again, as a reminder, the cuts proposed in the governor's bill is a 2.5% rate cut. And as Ms. Cullen already discussed, but I want to emphasize that that means that for every dollar cut from a nursing home, that's actually $3 lost to their operating budgets. And so we believe that the proposal before us is preferable to the 2.5% cut proposed by the governor, because we think that it will, on average, have less of an impact to nursing homes and therefore less of an impact to their ability to continue to meet the needs for seniors than what has been proposed by the governor. This certainly isn't an easy conversation. We know you have tough choices to make, and we're certainly appreciative of Senator Berglund for continuing to work with us and have the conversation. In a perfect world, we'd like to be here talking about positive things, but in light of having sort of two tricky issues on before us, a 2.5% cut versus a surcharge that would have the net impact of producing no cuts to our facilities, we believe that it is a benefit. In the past, the Long-Term Care Imperative has objected to surcharges in the past, primarily because it hasn't been, as some of you have talked about, been directed to primarily to older adult services. We think that this is a different situation because we think we're having publicly the conversation that the surcharge is a trade-off to what would otherwise be onerous cuts. And so that's why we're here having the position that we have here today. And so with that, I'd be also happy to answer any questions that you all may have. But again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Senator Corey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, if I'm in a nursing home and I'm private pay and I'm paying $5,000 a month, and this passes, will I pay an additional $485 a year?
Yes.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, yes.
$40 a month. Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, likewise, if we were lucky enough to be in a position to raise the rates of nursing homes by $40 a month, people would be paying $40 more if they were a private pay resident.
Senator Olson.
Well, okay. And this isn't my question, Madam Chair, but just to follow Senator Corrine's comment, the governor had proposed removing rate equalization, and if you were private pay under that, the rates could have gone up a couple $1,000s a month, or who knows what. There was no cap. So
I have no control over what the governor does.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson. Senator Berglund, my question is this. We're hearing that most nursing homes are going to be, you know, roughly held harmless under this proposal, but there apparently are some with a different case mix than what was described here who won't be. And I'm just wondering if you could describe those nursing homes and geographically if they're likely to be more located in one area versus another, has that analysis been done?
Madam Chair, Senator why Bergen. Don't I let the witnesses answer? Okay. This is not being aimed at any geographical area of the state, and it would depend on, I mean, if you have a large number of Medicare beds and combined with a large number of vacancies so that you would go over 20% in that category, then you would be negatively affected.
Well, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I have no doubt that it's not being aimed at any particular geographic area, but the net result could be that it affects some areas more than others. and if it should have a more disparate impact on some of the nursing homes that perhaps aren't as close to population centers in terms of maintaining their beds, but they're there because you don't have another nursing home without driving 2 or 3 hours, then it's going to have a greater impact on particular areas, and they're already, if those are nursing homes already being paid at a lower rate, that's the kind of concern I would have if that is in fact the case. So that's my question.
Ms. Cullen.
Senator, the only comment I would have on that is the last time we looked at this, there wasn't a particular geographic area, because it is a combination. The way our plan amendment has for the surcharge program is the surcharge is applied on all beds. And so if you have an empty bed that you have chosen not to place on layaway and you have chosen not to close, it applies to that bed. And it also applies to Medicare. And the two things I would say to that is Medicare is a more generous payer. So the Medicare bed shouldn't be an issue for our facilities, because Medicare is a more generous payer and you will be paid far more than the Medicaid rate would pay for a Medicare bed. In terms of an empty bed, we now have several choices for our members. You can pay the surcharge on an empty bed knowing that, you know, it's a small amount that's while you're waiting for admissions. You could put the bed on layaway, and we also have a closure incentive program, so that you have some choices on what you would do with that empty bed if you chose not to pay the surcharge. And that's what we instruct our members, is to take a look at your whole strategic plan. You may want to put your beds on layaway, and then you don't have to pay. And there's another bill pending right now that extends the layaway period to 10 years. Or you may want to get the 2080 per bed closure adjustment for that bed if you feel that that bed will no longer be needed in your community. So I think there are some choices for facilities that have more open beds.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Senator Prettner-Solin, did you have a question?
No, I pass. Madam Chair, the only Senator comment Prettner-Solin. I wanted to make is that this $485 would amount to about just over a dollar a day for private pay.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, it's interesting. I'm not sure about any of you, but I haven't really heard from my nursing homes, and I serve 12 of them, about this. So I'm just asking to the witnesses if they've okayed, this has all been vetted through, certainly with your organizations, but are the administrators aware of this? Because they were even up last week and they didn't mention this proposal. So I'm just a little off guard on this.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator if I can just remind Senator Rosen that we did have it in our bill last year. So this isn't like a new thing that's just being whipped out of a desk drawer.
Madam Chair, but I would like to hear from Ms. Cullen and to hear what are the sites saying on this, and the administrators?
Ms. Thurlow.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'll speak directly since it was our group from Aging Services that was up last week. We have had conversations with our members in our committee process, as well as through the long-term care imperative, that this possibility is out there. And certainly with folks that were up here for our lobbying days last week, let them know of the possibility. I think it's fair to say that everybody is sort of waiting, as I'm sure most of you are, to see kind of what is all on the table in terms of alternatives. And so this issue, while it's been out there for a while, we were just specifically asked to talk about this versus the governor's cut. So folks know about it. I think they're waiting to see all the budget proposals on the table before they get excited. But for the most conversations we've had is this versus a 2.5% cut. This is the preferred alternative right now.
In light of the time, we're going to try to wrap up. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is with regard to lines 3.19 and 3.20 that specifically the rate increase. And I maybe didn't ask this question specifically enough before, but this was what I was trying to get at. When we have different payment rates, based on geographic areas. If we were to, some of the proposals that we've had here before would increase that disparity gap between those geographic areas, because we are taking we're making our increases on a percentage basis, as opposed to just giving extra the same amount of extra dollars to every nursing home. And so the way that this would be handled, I mean, is this something that's factored then based on a multiplier, so that, or would it be dollar for dollar differences in payment based on the number of beds in a particular nursing home?
Ms. Cullen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I now see what you're saying. This does not impact rate disparities whatsoever. The category that this is put in is external fixed, so there's no case mix adjustment or anything, so it's outside of what you would probably consider the operating case mix adjusted rate system.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator
thank
Olson.
You. That was exactly, and that's what I needed to know.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Senator
if
Bergen.
There are no more questions, I would move that Senate File 2728, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you very much.
And members, our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday morning at 8:30 a.m. With that, our meeting is adjourned.